2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 325, The Experiences of LDS Women and How Their Culture Influences Manifestations of Their Sexuality, a paper presented by Jody Hildebrandt with a response by Mary Beth Raines.
Good morning. It's an honor to be here this morning and have you all participate with me to learn a little bit more about LDS women and how they have been, how their phenomenology has affected their sexuality. I wanted to first begin with a little bit of an introduction as to why I chose this particular topic. I was raised LDS and was in what I would call a traditional LDS home, and I, from a very young age, probably 9, 10 years old, my intuitiveness was telling me that I wasn't getting the whole story on many different fronts, and I never realized that questions were not being answered to their entirety and their fullness. And so as I matured and got married, I started asking friends of mine what their sexual experience was about, and it was then that I started realizing the responses were at times full of confusion, doubt, guilt, a lot of don'ts in their experiences, and at many times a lot of shame, much shame with that. And that stayed with me for many, many years, and it wasn't until I entered graduate school that I thought, you know, I don't want to just do a thesis to check off the box that I met the criteria. I wanted to add to some type of body of knowledge so that it would be significant. And I sat down with my chair, who is very feminist-oriented, and she would say, knowing my personality, I wanted to stir the pot a little bit as well. And so between the two of us, we decided to investigate this particular topic and set up some parameters as to ages, geographic location, things of that nature. So real quickly, before I get into the actual results, let me just give you a structural basis as to where I'm coming from. My design, my research design is called a grounded theory. And basically all that means is that hopefully by the time you're done with your project, you've come out with a different theory. I have not created a theory at this point. Hopefully something will emerge either further down the line or different ideas and different beliefs that have never been expressed before could emerge as well. It's also based on people's phenomenological perspective, which basically means how do they interpret their meanings? How do they construct their meanings? Give you a little introduction of the participants. There were 21 participants that I interviewed, and they were about an hour and a half to 2 hours long. They were open-ended questions, and they were questions that hopefully would not intimidate them. They were not, tell me the nitty-gritty of your sexual lives. It was more of, how do you feel about this? What do you consider your beliefs are about sexuality? Your sexual experience with your spouse, things of that nature. And at any given point, if they felt uncomfortable, they were able to basically say that, and the interview would be over. Like I said, 21 people participated, and after about a month into the project, three of them decided to retract their interviews, stating that they did not feel like this was appropriate to be talking about. That one woman stated that the spirit had told her that this was something that she shouldn't be doing, which really made me sad as a researcher because it sounded like there was a lot of fear underneath that. And when I first began this project, one of the components that I really wanted to make sure that I included was the typical, very conservative LDS perspective, which I knew would be very hard to find. And unfortunately, these three women, I feel, represented that perspective, but they've pulled out. So, I have great data, though. let's see. The ages were between 28 and 52. And they were all born and raised, well, they weren't born, but they were raised in Utah, anywhere in Utah. Four of the participants were born in other parts of the country, but came to Utah by the time they were 4 years old. So they were, through very crucial developmental stages, they were raised here in Utah. Half of the participants were eldest children, which I found very interesting. And all of their family members, their immediate family members, as they grew, they had at least five or more children. One of the women had 13 siblings. So they were all from fairly large families. All of the interviews were transcribed, and from those transcriptions, I was looking for, again, their constructions, their meanings of their life. So this is not a research project that is being run by numbers, as quantitative data would be. This is a qualitative study. We held three different focus groups, one in southern Utah, one in northern Utah, and then one in another state where some of the LDS women who were raised here in Utah had moved. And so there were four sessions of these particular focus groups, so one a week for about an hour and a half. And to control my own bias, I kept very intricate field notes and a journal for myself, because I related so closely to a lot of what these women were saying, I wanted to make very sure that I kept my own thoughts and feelings out of my results section, which I don't know if that's possible to the extent that I wanted it to be, but I tried. I was very cognizant of that. This is an overarching the four different categories that I placed my thousands of different statements from these women into. So they fell into a cultural context, messages about gender, personal development and familial context, and then the fourth, women, marriage, and sexuality. And underneath each one of these are different subtopics that are further described in the results. And as I was preparing this, there's just such a massive amount of data that I have, and I knew that I only had a little bit of time, and so I wanted to spend the majority of the time talking about the actual results and quoting to you, giving you these women's voices. So the first topic, let's talk about menstruation. And the thing I found very interesting about this was the component of their mothers was such a rich and I guess it kind of hit me blindsided. I didn't think that the mother image in their lives would have held so much emphasis as it did. They brought this up time and time and time again about the way that they receive values, the beliefs that they have today were inspired, were promoted by their mothers. Fathers were not mentioned all that much, which surprised me. And this topic about menstruation, many of them said that they wished that their mothers would have spoken more direct, been more honest about this. So I'll give you some figures. 18 women talked about their first introduction was through the state program that you receive 5th, 6th, 7th grade for girls and boys. And after that period, four of them had menstruation expounded on by their mothers. The others either learned from friends or figured it out on their own. So let me just read real quick. Okay, this is Kendra, and all of the names are pseudonyms, so protect their identity. Kendra is 32 years old, and she said, "I learned about it from school, sixth grade menstruation program. They made you and your mom come with you. It was interesting. I don't remember too much of the movie, though. I think it was outdated, and ooh, it made me gross out. I remember I was in the gym at school and had the movie, and I just felt weird. I didn't know anything about it. Even afterwards, I still felt awkward about the whole thing. We had to do it again in seventh grade, but they didn't have the parents come with us. We were separated from the boys and the girls, and I thought that was the best way. Here's another experience from another woman. This is Valerie. We were traveling across the country, and I had a streak on my underwear, and I was scared. And my mom came in and said, "You're just having your period. It's okay." She handed me a pad and showed me how to use it. I was like 9 or 10. It was very positive, and I felt very good about it. It was a healthy thing, and every girl has one. And it's important because you'll have a baby someday, and it's okay. I felt okay about it, and I knew what to do. It was very important that she taught me what she taught me. She also told me to put all the evidence in the right place. We kept it from my brothers because it was none of their business, because it was a girl thing. She was teaching me to be discreet about it because it was distasteful to see. You know, the carelessness of it. And I passed that on to my own daughters. Let me read another excerpt about another one of the women's experiences with menstruation. This is Nicole. Nicole stated she was more confused about menstruation because of the story her mother had told her. My mother's mother made her stand in a basin and let the blood flow down from her legs. It scared and confused me that she was telling me this. How could that happen in my family? My mother tried to convince me that it wasn't dirty and that it was something totally natural. But after that story, I didn't believe her. Why would a mother do that to her daughter? I got mixed signals from my mother after that story. I thought, why is she even telling me this? After that story, we went to the seventh grade movie, and she never again, ever, said anything to me about reproduction. Ellie recalled an experience with her brother, seeing her mother's feminine hygiene in the garbage. She described the scene in a perplexing tone. She thought, as she was experiencing again, she described the scene as though she was experiencing it again as a child. She stated, "My brother and I would see her pads in the garbage and open them up and think, she must have a huge cut. I have talked to my girls about intercourse at age 5 and 7, and I'm thinking that I was old enough to have my mom tell me, but she never said a thing. I had no idea what a pad was. I just thought she must have had a cut someplace and needed it for her head or her nose or something." What I'm doing is I'm mostly focusing down here on these results down here at the bottom on section 4. These first three encompass about 250 pages, so I thought I'd focus more on this last section of sexuality. Next topic is on children and sex. Who should talk to their children about sex, and in what context should it be delivered? Six women address their comfort levels in regard to the discussion of sex and sexuality with their children. For example, Ellie stated her surprise for how much her child knew about the intricacies of life and how she is not ready for them to grow up yet. She stated, "My daughter knows it takes a man and a woman, but hopefully it's a puzzle from there. I'm not ready for that yet. She knows some things, like what the birth control pills do, but my mom never told me anything about that, and so I'm not ready for her to grow up yet. I don't know if she knows about sex. I tried to give her the menstruation talk, but I have not had the birds and the bees talk with her yet. She's probably old enough because I'm sure they talk about those things in school, and next year they'll have the film. She knows a lot more about it than I did at her age, how to make babies and stuff, but I'm still not comfortable talking about it with my children. I want to keep them young, you know? So talking about sex and all the stuff that goes with it, especially with a 9-year-old who hasn't learned that there are certain boundaries that she can't cross that her 5-year-old sister can, is difficult. But I plan on taking a little bit more time than my mother did in talking to her. April explained that she felt very comfortable talking with her children about sex. However, she commented on the anxiety she felt as a child because her parents failed to talk to her about the maturation process. She stated, "I don't want my children to go through what I went through when I was their age. There was no talking." Jenny likewise stated, "I don't want to do that to my kids. I want them to be able to come to me and ask questions. I hope that they will. I wish that my parents would have done that differently with me." Definitions of healthy sexuality. The preceding comments were made on this particular topic. The above quotations identified some of the concerns regarding the issues of sexuality. Included among the topic of sexuality is the ambiguous question of what is healthy sexuality. 15 participants took the opportunity to reply to this riveting question, and their responses are as follows. Abstinence was one of the ways that women described how a healthy sexual or healthy sexuality, that remaining abstinent was a way to be healthy sexually. Sarah explained how abstinence was something that was expected from their children when she stated, "Abstinence. If I were to define healthy sexuality to my boys, I would define it in that way. I would do it in a way that is positive for them to hear, that everybody has those desires, but the healthy part is to abstain until you're married. Only have one partner, and that definitely is the most healthy way." Nancy likewise embraced this definition of one partner. Healthy sexuality would definitely be defined with one partner, and hopefully that one partner would stay with you as that one partner. There are so many diseases, and that's how I would define it. As soon as you get off into the pornography, or even looking at that kind of stuff, your mind does different things. A third explanation of healthy sexuality, as two women described, is having sex within a marriage with an opposite sex partner, with a component of commitment. Becca stated, "Being healthy sexually means being sexually active with a husband or wife, meaning married, committed relationship with whom you are best friends, meaning all the things that best friends are." April described the commitment as, "You get the lines and the bags and the bigger butt and everything like that, but he still loves you, and it's nice to know that." Two participants noted that mutual satisfaction and cherishing are the most important elements of a healthy sexual person. Nicole, for example, explained, "It just makes you feel good. There's nothing dirty, out of line. It's done in love, and two people enjoy it. Not one, but two people enjoy it. Something that you would cherish." Next topic I'd like to talk about is on masturbation. That's one way that when I asked, let's see, I think I can't find it right off, but there were a handful of women, maybe 3 or 4 women, that commented that masturbation was not a healthy sexual component, and that when I pushed them to describe what would be considered healthy sexuality for themselves, they would not answer. It was more of, this is what it's not. Valerie viewed healthy sexuality as being able to turn her husband on and excite him. She stated, "Sexuality is that part of how my husband would use me. And even though I am an awful size now and don't feel very good about myself, my husband always makes me feel like a woman. And that to me is the sensual in the sexuality. Sexuality is the ability to turn him on. He is turned on just because he loves me. And he doesn't have to have a physical picture to do so." A three participants spoke on the topic of masturbation within the LDS Church. One participant wanted to know if other women of the LDS faith had sexual feelings and what they did with them. Sophia commented that she did not, quote, know women masturbated until 5 years ago. Sophia is 34 years old. Two women remarked that they knew men, quote, did, because the attention was so heavily directed towards them, unquote, that they did not know about women, quote, doing it, unquote. Brooke stated, the question always was, am I an anomaly in terms of a young woman, or do other young women have these feelings too, and do something or not about it? And actually, I knew that young men did, because they were talked pretty strongly. I was aware that the young men were talked to about it, and that's where I heard more of it. But it was more around the young men. I don't remember hearing about any connection with me as a young woman, as a girl. With the majority of the LDS focus on the male regarding masturbation and the appropriateness or inappropriateness of that behavior, Ellie felt the need to speak to her son concerning the behavior. I had to tell my son the other day about masturbation. I can easily talk to my girls than I can my son about this. I told him that it might feel good to touch yourself, but you shouldn't be doing that. He was not really embarrassed, though. It was more like he was thinking about it and what I was saying. He was 9 when I talked to him. I wanted my husband to do it, but he said that wasn't going to happen and I needed to do it. The consequences of messages regarding masturbation is the guilt that inherently follows. Brooke, though never being told directly that this behavior was unacceptable, knew that it must not be a good thing instinctively. She stated, there was a guilt connected to it that I just imagined was probably not a good thing, but at that point I didn't hear much about it. In fact, I don't think I heard much about it in young women's or anywhere, ever, but I felt guilt about it, even though I had not been told directly it was wrong. Sophia felt guilt as well, yet desired to let it go. Listen to her struggle. I wish I could let go and not have the guilt. Sometimes we do things that are pleasurable for me and it makes me feel guilty and I wish I didn't have to feel that way. Sometimes it's easier for me to say, quote, let's not do it so that I don't feel guilty. I guess if we don't have to do it, I don't have to deal with the guilt of doing something wrong. I know it's the voice of my mother that makes me feel this way. I hear her saying it's gross and wrong and then I feel guilty. Messages from friends, siblings, and parents regarding sex and sexuality. 9 women addressed the topic of the mechanics and physical nature of sex in multiple ways. For example, Wendy talked about messages of, quote, it really taking a while before you enjoy it, unquote. She stated, she's talking about her friend here. She told me it was not something that I could expect to enjoy for a while, and she was right. It does take a while. She was talking about girls climaxing, and that's what it takes, and it takes a while. Some friends got married, and they told me that if you had sex a lot, your skin would clear up, and I thought, it will? I keep smiling because I keep having these women's images in my head. I just feel so honored that they spoke to me. Sally saw herself as, quote, more of a listener when it came to sex and sexuality. She remarked, we talked about things, but I didn't ask a lot of questions. I was curious, and they were the ones that showed me the books, what a boy looks like in high school. That was the first time I had seen one. Sophia learned how to please a guy from her friends, and they had the opportunity to experiment with one. She stated, I learned from the school playground and asking questions and listening. I didn't ask a lot of questions. I think I learned a lot of backseat sex because these girls aren't married and they're just telling about their little escapades. So I heard about the mechanics of sex, but you really don't hear about the emotions and the feelings. My brain put it on the back burner because I was so far away from having sex in high school. With my first husband, we experimented a lot, and I was lucky that I was still a virgin when I was married. For Lydia, she was too embarrassed to speak of the subject. She remarked, I remember talking a lot about it with my friends. I don't think it was talked about a lot, though. I know we were all really nervous for it when we got married. The big joke was, nobody ever died on that first night. At that time in my life, I still wasn't comfortable discussing it with people. I think my friends knew a lot, and I didn't really enjoy talking about it, so I just didn't. I would feel too embarrassed. My friends were sensitive to that fear and the fact that I really wasn't ready for it. Okay, these are messages from siblings that these women received. The majority of the participants stated that they did not hear any direct, overt messages, yet a few heard messages of various degrees regarding the subject from siblings. For example, April recalled hearing from her siblings a talk that she had with her sister before she was going in to be married. She explained that this was hours before she went into the temple, and she had not heard anything about what was to come from parents, from friends, from siblings. And her sister took her aside in a McDonald's, hours before she got married, and she thought, oh, this is going to happen now. She's going to tell me about it. And this is what she said to me. Hours before I was to be married, my sister took me aside. I thought that she was going to talk to me about sex, but she didn't. She talked to me only about what was going to happen in the temple. And I didn't write any further information, but to remember her face when she explained that, even though she'd been married for 18 years at this point and had 4 children, she still had this look of just emptiness, like, nobody explained this to me. And further in the results, I don't know if I'll get to it today, but further in the results, she talks about her experience on her honeymoon. Messages from parents. Many messages are experienced through implied and covert means, which can have as powerful as an impact as the ones taught overtly and frankly. This discussion looks at the messages participants received that they were taught by parents. 12 women. Okay. I knew this was going to happen. We're going to run out of time. Okay. This is Sarah speaking. Nothing. Nothing. I heard nothing. They would never discuss it with me. I had no idea what it was about. It was never discussed in our home, and I think that's probably with all Mormons. You never discuss it. You never talk about anything, you know, never. I don't think my mother really enjoyed sex. I think the only purpose for her was to have children. I think that was the feeling in my parents' marriage, but they would never say that or discuss it. My friend's mother bought me a book before I was married and gave it to me to read, or I would have been like, duh. But that was as far as it went when talking about sex. That was the extent of it. I remember that it was a private thing, and that was it. I am going to skip over to church messages because we only have about 10 minutes. Just as I'm doing that, other subtopics are underneath this particular category are consequences of sexual messages, negative sexual messages, reactions to messages about sex, talking of sex and sexuality, first sexual encounter, thoughts about themselves as sexual beings, just what their interpretation is of that. And then the last one is church messages about sex. So let's just skip there. I was talking to my chair about 6 months ago, and I came in with like a 350-page result section, and she's like, oh, Jody. She's like, you've got to cut that down. I said, oh, but I can't. I have to keep it all. She's been very patient with me. Okay. The primary purpose of this thesis was to answer the question, has the LDS Church influenced its female members in their manifestations of their sexuality? In other words, has the LDS Church affected women's sexual views of themselves with overt or covert messages that were sent during their developmental years? One of the messages, though there were many, was the message of the need to remain sexually pure, modest, and chaste before marriage. 7 of 18 participants commented on this particular message. Nicole gives an example. She stated, "The main thing was to keep yourself pure, and that was taught from primary up to mutual. I loved and admired my mutual teachers and believed them 100% and figured that this fairy tale at the end of the line came because of how you lived as a pure woman. The way the teachers taught was always in the form, of a story about someone who had not stayed on the right course. Their life had changed because of it." You know, can you reach down there and get my glasses? My eyes are they're just in that little black case. Thank you. Okay, much better. So the message was taught that their life was changed because they had not stayed on the right course. It was told in such a way that it made you want to stay close to the teachings that you knew were right, although it was always a downer story. The only message was to stay pure. There was not any direction other than that. There weren't any don'ts, only to stay pure. At church, I don't remember anything ever being talked about, like petting and stuff. That was all done at school. I think they were afraid to say or even suggest anything because kids might go out and try it. The, quote, staying pure comment must have been a generational thing. And as I read that, I remember that there was a real distinct separation between women who were late 20s to about 40 and then 40 to 50. And the women who were in the older section didn't hear a lot of messages about petting and about the mechanics of sex. It was more of just a moral issue. And a few of them said, "I really believe that kids are experimenting more, and the church has, within the last 20 years, had to talk more about, had been forced to talk more about the mechanics." So that was one thing that came up as I was interviewing them. Like I said, seven different people talked about the importance of staying modest and pure and chaste. Three women vividly. Makes you nervous. Okay, you have 5 minutes. Okay, you have 10 minutes. Thank you, though. I know you are. Thank you very much. Three women vividly recalled having their sexuality referred to as a used vehicle or as a tarnished rose or flower. Jane recounted her experience. "There was a lesson once with a white handkerchief which was supposed to be used as a symbol of purity. There was another lesson with a white rose, and it was passed around for everyone to touch and how it became all, and then we watched how it became all wilted and brown. You wanted to be the whole rose when you were married. You didn't want to have the brown edges. I thought that it was a good analogy because there's a right time to pick a flower and there's not. If you pick it too soon, then it's not going to be able to fulfill its whole potential. So I think the stories like that, even though they had a negative, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Let me just skip that. The focus of the talk was to both men and women, because it was about a boy touching the rose bushes. Another lesson or story was about a boy going out on a date and having his parents remind him that this is somebody's sister, just like your sister. Make sure you treat her the way you'd want to have someone treat your sister. Nancy recalled a similar story when she remembered the analogy of being referred to as a used vehicle. "I was thinking if I kissed someone that I was the used vehicle. There's been seminary teachers who have talked about things like that. Some of them have been fanatical and you just roll your eyes and go, yeah, right. But it makes you think. We had a lot of classes on dating. No single dating, only group dating. We learned a lot about not having a boyfriend, but staying in a group. You want to stay clean and pure for your Prince Charming. You know, don't kiss all the toes type of thing. Just fun lessons like that along the way. But really stay clean and pure for that special boy. That was the main lesson you learned. don't try everybody out, because when the boys come to get married, they don't want to have a used vehicle. Those are the lessons I remember. Okay. Along with those messages were comments about the don'ts of sex, as I referred to them. The messages were, this is from Kendra, the messages were that, quote, you don't do this and you don't do that, and you don't do any necking or touching, and definitely you don't do sex. For Sophia, she learned similar locutions. You don't make out and you don't do any petting. I know they stress double dating, and don't be alone after dark. I remember that very clearly. Don't be alone after dark, because that's when problems happen. Problems meant having sex, petting, getting pregnant. It's easy for me to be told the don'ts because I stay in line and follow the rules and the laws. I heard a lot of don'ts. Jenny's interpretation of the rhetoric was vigorous. She was very impassioned about the messages and cues she received as she described them in great detail. As she was talking, her body language was also communicating a story of its own. She took her fingers and began pointing to them as she was naming all the things she recalled she was not supposed to do. So as I sat there with her, she had out both hands and she was doing this as she went through all of these things. She stated, you don't look at that and you don't look at this, and you don't do that and you don't do this, and you don't do that, you know. Don't look at magazines, don't see movies, don't read books, don't sit in the back seat with a boy, don't lie horizontal, don't ever, ever, just don't. And so I never did. And now I can, and I can't. I can't get that out of my head. I don't know why. So that's probably why I was told just don't. Another topic is on puzzling and confusing messages. One of the questions I asked these women was, with the information that we've talked about and regarding the topics of women and sexuality, what would be some puzzling and confusing messages that you felt were interpreted by yourself? And there was very interesting their responses. 14 of the 18 women commented on this particular question. Some of them said, I didn't hear anything puzzling or confusing. And I pushed them with one more additional question, and they said, no, I think that everything that the church has taught me is right on, and I think that I'm very clear on what they've discussed. So I left that one alone. But 14 of them spoke on this topic. One participant, Brooke, felt that one of the most puzzling messages she received as a woman was that women are responsible for men's sexuality. She spoke with much conviction in her voice and concluded towards the end that she was feeling anger when she spoke on the subject. I think I heard a lot of mixed messages, actually. I learned that it was wonderful and natural, the feeling of sexuality. It was a sacred experience, that even the word sex seemed to demean what it is, and that it should only be done in marriage, and that playing around with that powerful gift is dangerous. Danger and gift together in the same context is really an oxymoron. The other messages I heard were that it's a bad thing, that it's all the things like fire and you shouldn't play with it, that you need to stay far away from it until the appropriate time, and then it's fine. And then it's fine only in certain ways, and you better just figure out what those ways are and be certain, because nobody's going to tell you directly. But somehow you've got to get it. You've got to understand it. But before that, don't get really intimate with someone. Don't get excited. Don't play with this. Don't play with that. It's more of the responsibility of the woman than it is the man to keep things within the appropriate boundaries. And that's her responsibility in the way she dresses and the way she acts and helping the young man stay clean so that he can go on his mission and do all those sorts of things. So I was capable of being both the temptress and the one who was supposed to be taking responsibility to make sure that we stay within appropriate bounds. And I just think that's a lot. It actually makes me mad, even talking about it. Lydia, commented on the silence and how that made her very confused, and she always questioned as to why the hush, quote-unquote, if this element in life is so beautiful and sanctioned by God. Probably the fact that we didn't talk about it, the silence around it, made me most confused. We still don't talk about it. The church says it's okay as long as you're doing it in the right boundaries, so why can't it be discussed? I still don't get it. I just don't get it. And so that's probably the most confusing, biggest thing right there, is that I just don't get the silence. Okay. Alrighty. The other thing I was going to talk about is I asked all of them if they could change something in the church surrounding these particular topics, what would it be? What intuitive wisdom would they share with church leaders as far as change around sexuality, around womanhood? And unfortunately, we're not going to be able to get that, but am I just done, or do we open up for questions, or how do we do that?
Well,
okay. Alrighty. Sorry to leave you hanging on that last one. Thank you very much.
Good morning. Jody addressed the question of her thesis, which is, does culture affect sexuality, particularly does Mormon culture affect sexuality? And as you might know, the whole field of sociology is operated on that very premise, that the larger premise that culture affects, that's how we learn, and it's what those effects are. And essentially, I see in summary that her a conclusion is that Mormon culture does have a profound effect on sexuality, and that that effect is double-focused. There's an effect of how something is wonderful, how it is important, and that's the gift, and yet it's dangerous and must be handled carefully, and that the primary process that's been used has been one of not speaking or silence or giving messages about no. And I believe that that's fundamentally correct from the studies and research and reading that I've had over a number of years. In fact, there's been, in terms of the kind of research that she's done, qualitative research, there's been a surge in qualitative research in the last few years or the last decade. And fortunately, I've had some contact with people who have done some of that work. And I think it's a very important kind of work. It's different than qualitative work that most of us are acquainted with, and so we're acquainted with numbers. And some of you may remember that a number of years ago, I with two other women, did a research study on the same topic of married women, married LDS women and sex, and that was a quantitative research project. Both of those research projects yielded somewhat the same conclusions, and both of them had the same problems, and that is, they're not random studies. They're not over a large group of people. They were selected as we could find them, sort of a snowball sample, as it were, to find somebody and then find somebody, and, well, if there's somebody else, find them too. And so we actually don't know. That's the conclusion. We don't actually know how Mormon culture affects women's sexuality in a large range. We know about the problems, and one of the reasons is that on any discussion topic or any topic in our lives that's really, really important, we're oftentimes more readily able to talk about what doesn't work than what does work. Many relationships reflect this, that it's more easy to focus on what they'd like fixed than their enjoyment on a day-to-day basis. Think about your car, you talk about your car, you may like it, you may even have it inside all of the wonderful drives you have, but if you talk about your car, around, are there problems, are there not problems, and cars aren't particularly dangerous. So I would like to make a couple of comments that link the qualitative to the quantitative and say that the both are important, that even though we don't know, these are at least some insights and some awareness and can take us somewhere despite that lack of large knowing. One of the things that small non-random samples do, both in the quantitative one that I did and the qualitative one that she's doing, is it gives us places to look. And it also helps us to link depth with breadth. the kind of depth that comes from qualitative helps us frame where we look in terms of breadth, and I think that's important. It links the emotions to the heart. The kind of stories that Jody told gives an emotional response, particularly about the shocking stories, McDonald's 3 hours before you enter the temple, for instance, in a way that quantitative research does not, and I think both give us a more full three-dimensional picture. However, I think that it's also important to be able to link whatever we find in Mormon culture in terms of both qualitative and quantitative to what's true in the larger world. And fortunately, there have been a lot more research articles, a lot more findings nationwide about women's sexuality, and to some extent, women's sexuality in connection with religion. And what I notice in comparing the little bits we know about Mormon women and sexuality is that it's true nationwide. The information coming out about women's sexuality nationwide has a number of focal points. One of those is that, well, we're all in trouble. What it means is that a significantly higher proportion of women have difficulty with their sexuality, with their sexual response cycle, understanding it and making it fit in a marriage more than men do. Although, as one male client many years explained to me, says, you really have to understand that for most of us men, that bad sex is still, well, good sex. or as the other way to focus the difference between the two, another one told me, well, you know, women need a reason to have sex, and men just need a place. So this may be an inherently... you can see why maybe... hard to talk across the table or across the bed about such topics, right? Any case, in terms of the nationwide research, these are just smattering reports, that 30 to 40% of American women have some sexual dysfunction. Somewhere between 20 and 30% have had some sexual abuse or molestation in their life, which always impacts sexual functioning. 50% of women do not orgasm with penetration. And given that that's been sort of a sign of whether you're a real woman or not, you know, whether you can have orgasm with penetration, it's caused enormous sort of difficulties. The fortunate part of all of... the fourth one is that the more closed a culture, the more likely one is to have difficulty sexually because you don't have access to education and discussion in the same way that other topics do where we're open to having education and discussion. And it does a second thing, which is that it frames the premises. That is, sex is only to be enjoyed or understood in a particular way rather than going the opposite way we do about a number of other topics, say reading, for instance, that we learn to read and that we read across a wide variety of things. And then we tailor that according to whether it's our interest principles or moral principles or whatever. So it frames the premise. And then when you learn more about it, the conflict comes out of that. So what I would say, and there are other people who say this, that when there is a closed culture, there inherently is a very difficulty with that dilemma of how do you go and where do you go? How do you make sense of it? And how do you come to that difficult process of a lot of guilt and anxiety of making choices for your own and finding your own voice within it? And a lot of couples, married Mormon couples, as I've talked with them over the years, have a lot of difficulty about that, and they'll have different opinion about what is to be done and not done, and we don't have any research about that. The good news is we're all talking about it more. There's talking about it more in the national press, from whether it's Red Book or research article reports in the newspaper to academic findings, and the most that's known is in academic findings, and that's least available to everybody. So at least the newspapers are kind of a common middle ground, and they tend to report it more and more, and people are readers of newspapers. And one thing we know about Mormons is that they are as American as they are Mormon. And so, essentially, most of us find a way to pull in all of the American culture, research, findings, discussions, and create it in our own. And to a large extent, we are Americans, and then we are Mormons within that framework. We keep Mormon values if you're highly Orthodox Mormon, but you're very American. So you will read the stuff in the newspapers, what I'm trying to say, and then you'll pull it back and frame it in terms of what you think is right or not right. But essentially, I think that's good news. I always, as a clinician, want to end with the question of, what do we do now? I realize I'm giving a very brief and broad overview about all of this, but I have some ideas. One of them is that it may be important for all of us, given that we only have our own selves to start with and our own families, to read more and particularly talk more about sexuality with those around us. Now, one place where sexuality is talked about quite openly and quite explicitly and quite wonderfully is in women's groups. Women will talk about sex to each other, and they will talk very openly about sex to each other in ways that men never talk to openly to about sex to each other. Men will tell stories, but women compare notes. However, I have to say this one ethical thing about women, which I really value, and that is in all of the discussions I've had in the many women's groups I've been in over the years that talk about sex pretty openly, we actually keep confidences about what actually we do with our man, or in case of your lesbian, with our woman. We don't actually say who did what, when, how. We talk mostly about how we feel, how we react, what we do, what we don't do, and all of the others implied, of course, because, you know, the partner fits in some way or another into that. But that's where most of the talking goes on. And I would suggest men, since there are a number of you here, and I'm assuming you're interested in sex, not just because you're here, but because you're men, that you find ways to start talking to each other, start comparing notes. It's an enormous revelation. And so I would say doing that, and what that does is then kids start hearing you discuss this sort of stuff. Or even your adult children. I have to say, adult children can learn as much as younger children because it is now just part of their life. And I've been to two women's situations in the last couple of days in which an adult daughter of one of the women were there, and they were like absolutely floored, going, "This is amazing. I'm going to do this with my girlfriends. I'm going to pull this around and talk." Also, we weren't explicitly talking about sex, although that could have gotten there easily. The second thing I would say is that to any dilemma that you have in your life, a sexual dilemma, whether it's about dysfunction, whether it's about trauma, whether it's about difficulty with your partner, that you adopt the premise, just trust me on this one, just believe it and then take it, okay? My only authoritarian statement today, which is there are ways out of dilemmas. You may not know what it is, and we generally have so much anxiety or guilt about sex, but there are ways out. There are people to talk to. There are things to read. The internet has many sexual sites that are very informative, and they're not necessarily pornographic. You will get all the pornographic cookies if you, you know, get into them, but maybe you know how to delete those. I don't quite yet. The other is learn how to enjoy yourself, because sex is in our bodies. I know that the biggest sexual organ is the brain. No, that's not true. The skin. And then the brain is next, and then genitalia are the next in terms of size. But sex is a body experience, and the more you enjoy yourself and you let that sensuality move out through the rest of your life, people notice it, feel it, and that is an important way of transmission and understanding, as is the verbal mode or the discussion or the understanding mode or the teaching mode. And so it just transforms us, don't you think? When we're around somebody who really enjoys themselves in their body. There's something that occurs that aliveness is communicated, and we enjoy ourselves just being in the neighborhood or just being next to that person. The last thing I would say is that it's really important to focus on the resolution of guilt. Just one famous family therapist, Frank Pittman, who says, guilt is useful if it lasts 5 minutes and produces change. And I realize that most sexual guilt is going to last a lot longer than 5 minutes. However, I would say that the focus on the resolution in your own life of guilt, let me tell you a quick story. I know a person who was a branch president or a bishop in a missionary training center ward as such for those 2 months that missionaries go through of their foreign language and so on. And he said he took it as part of his mission during those 5 years that he was bishop to, when he had the interviews and called everybody in, to actually inquire about what they felt guilty about, whatever range it was, and most often it was sexual. And he said, "I saw it my given duty to figure out a way to forgive them on the spot and to say, whatever you need to do recompense or whatever, let's do it now while you're here. I'm not going to call up your stake president. I'm not going to send you home. But you need to go into the mission field with your head clear and your heart open so you really can work to serve the Lord. And it's that focus of saying, find a way to resolve the guilt, the dilemmas within us, so it actually uncaps the spring and we can enjoy our sexuality all that much more. Thank you. Okay, we just have a couple of minutes, but I know that Jody really wants to take questions and give y'all a chance to respond. So if you'll come up here so it'll be caught on the tape, that would be great.
I just have an example, a story to tell. I was teaching the young women quite a few years back, and I had a daughter and her friends who were about 16 who were in my class, and I knew what they were going through, and they were really struggling with the issues of petting at that time. And we had the lesson designed that time was they were going to ask private questions about sexual things, and that I would try and discuss it, you know, in our small little group. And, you know, the question that many, many of them wanted to know was, how far is too far? You know, how far can I go, you know, before I've gone too far? And, you know, and I guess I was tired of the hypocrites, you know, in the church. And I knew, you know, I wanted to say, you know, I'll bet 90% of your parents petted before they got married. You know, I wanted to say that, but I didn't quite dare say that. But what I did say, and it kind of got me in a lot of trouble and I was released from my position, was that I said, you know, you keep your pants on, he keeps his pants on. And, you know, I thought that was pretty good advice, but it got back to the Relief Society president, to the bishop, and I had this little talk. And, I mean, the thing that I wanted to do and to teach them was that the important thing was I wanted them to keep coming back to church. I wanted the guilt to not take over their lives so that they didn't feel like they could be in young women's or in sacrament meeting or in church. And that, you know, that to, you know, not to make him feel so absolutely guilty about what was, you know, probably going to happen to them. And anyway, I guess that's probably pretty typical. It's not really a question. It's just, I just get really tired of, you know, the hypocrites in the church who I know were doing all kinds of things. Maybe they didn't have sex, but they did everything else but that before they got married. Many of them did. So.
While she's coming up, let me say I interviewed June Reinisch, who was head of the Kinsey Sex Institute, it was years ago, and asked, what's the difference between religious people and non-religious people in terms of masturbation rates, extramarital sex rates, and so on? She says, there isn't any. The difference is the guilt.
I had a question about women's first sexual experiences, especially in a culture where, you know, there are so many restraints on, you know, the appropriate circumstances for that, and whether these women had good first sexual experiences or if they had to grow into that.
Let me just say that I'm wanting to put all of this into a book at some point. I'm trying to get Desert Book to publish it. They're a little shaky. But, you know, if I can write it appropriately, they said, then they would be very interested. So, you know, we're keeping our fingers crossed. Yeah. So anyways, to respond to your question, the majority of them did not have a positive first sexual experience. There was a handful, probably five or six people who could delineate between the timing of it. They could realize that, okay, now that I'm married, it's okay, and they could let it all go. But a lot of them wanted to, but could not get those don'ts, all of the implied negativity out of their head. In fact, there's a whole section in here about that very element of how do we change this in the church. That's one of the changes that many women commented on, was that we need to talk differently to our young people. We need to talk differently to our children. We need to not have the negative interpretations with sexuality. So, good question. Yes?
Just a comment about your question. I work with survivors of incest and sexual abuse, and I think that really complicates.
Could you kind of get away to get on the tape? You have everything important to say. We
Mary Beth is very kind.
Your name's Glenn?
Yes.
Nice to meet you, Glenn.
Hi. I was going to say, in partial response, I work a great deal with survivors of incest sexual abuse, both females and males. And even with Masters and Johnson, the first sexual experience, though it doesn't determine sexuality or anything like that and may not make a lot of difference, it seems to be, at least in their research, more complicating with some females, particularly if it's of the nature of long, ongoing incest. I mean, I think that's really unfortunate. So I did want to specify that there are instances it does make a negative difference that lingers, and it's something we need to talk about. Also, for the panel, because I sat in a panel of primarily women yesterday presentation, and one of the women stated that she did not feel our church was puritanical. And I was like, well, as a therapist, I was shocked, because I've always found our messages very puritanical. I don't think it was just my family, who really just didn't talk about it, but... And I talked to the three women afterwards, and all of them agreed that it wasn't puritanical. And when I gave them examples and how it goes in the culture, they said, well, it is puritanical, but that's good. Because it keeps people from being sexually active. The women on the panel, my point of view is, as a therapist, etc., is that... that we are somewhat of a puritanical culture, and that creates a... I'm not saying it doesn't do some things, but it does create a, in my judgment, some problems. Do men and women see that significantly differently? That may be more positive? Or do you not see Mormonism as a puritanical culture, that we give puritanical messages?
Can I just say... Overtime, 5 minutes, but I doubt that anybody's going to be coming in, they'll be coming in shortly. I have to go present, so I'm going to leave you all.
Let me answer Glenn's question and then give another answer, which is, I think puritanical, the answer is yes, that there are strong messages about limited sexuality and about no, don't do this and this and that. For me, the real question is, can you value sex in marriage only, but teach it and have a high compliance rate using positive methods instead of negative ones? To me, that's the core question. And I think the answer is yes. Because you don't have, you have all variations of a compliance rate anyway, even among married people. And so that's the question, and I think much as we have, with parenting techniques over the last half century, have gone from using primarily negative methods to partly positive methods, we now have models of parenting that are primarily positive, even around very difficult disciplinary issues, and we have found positive ways of doing that, and I think we can use that as a really helpful model. Thanks.
Thank you all for coming.
I'm hearing you. I'm going to get you my dissertation.